In the first hour of our program today, we'll be talking about the creation of the United Nations. Frequently, when people think about who it was ultimately responsible for the body coming to be, a lot of the credit has been given to Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. And while certainly they and their governments were important forces in this effort, the United Nations owes its existence to the combined efforts of a number of people, and some of them well-known names in American politics, but others that have since that time been forgotten. We'll talk this morning about some of these people, about how it is that they all came together in the spring and summer of 1945, and how it is that the United Nations came to have the shape and the design that it does. And our guest for the program this morning is Stephen Schlesinger. He's the author of a book on this, which is titled Act of Creation, The Founding of the United Nations. It's published by the Westview Press. Stephen Schlesinger is director of the World Policy Institute at the New School University in New York City. He also worked at the United Nations in the mid-1990s, and he served as speechwriter and foreign policy advisor to the governor, then-governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, for 12 years. He's a frequent contributor to magazines and newspapers, including The Washington Post, The LA Times, The Nation, and The New York Observer. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. They're always welcome. People can really help us, though, by being brief. That way we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving. So if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Schlesinger, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
You, I gather that part of your reason for wanting to do this book and to tell this story is that you feel that it's a story that's perhaps not well known, and that the contributions of various people, some of them, as I say, that really have been forgotten, need to be acknowledged.
There's no question that a lot of individuals who should really be prominent in American history for having created the United Nations have never gotten this kind of recognition. That really was one of the purposes for writing this book. And the second purpose is that nobody's ever written a book about the San Francisco Conference that devised, drafted, and produced the document which is now known as the UN Charter.
Harry Truman had a very strong commitment to the idea of the United Nations, and apparently it's when Franklin Roosevelt died and Truman became president, and it seemed that it was one of the first things that he was asked about and one of the first things on the agenda. Why was it that Truman felt that this was so important?
It's a very interesting fact that here was a man, Harry Truman, who had never gone to college, who'd been to Europe once in his life when he fought in the First World War, and otherwise was not identified with international issues, should become the champion of the United Nations. But the truth is that 13 days before the San Francisco Conference was to begin, Franklin Roosevelt died, and Truman had to succeed to him. Obviously, he was vice president. And he was faced with this conundrum, whether he should go forward with the UN conference or not. It was his first decision in office to instruct the State Department and his foreign policy team to indeed go forward with the conference and allow the UN emissaries from some 46 countries to convene in San Francisco. And it was because he did have an instinct for global affairs, even though he was not educated in them. In fact, he'd carried around in his wallet for almost 50 years a poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson mm-hmm. called Locksley Hall, which endorses the notion of a federation of states. Just to quote very briefly from the poem, "For I dipped into the future, far as human eye could see, saw the vision of the world and all the wonders that would be, till the war drum throbbed no longer and the battle flags were furled in the parliament of man and the federation of the world." This was the poem that literally Truman had put in his wallet and carried around for five decades. So he was a very committed internationalist, though that was in his reputation.
All of the people concerned here involved had to be very conscious of the fact that once before, after World War I, there had been an effort to build a similar organization, and ultimately it had failed. Probably there are a number of reasons for the failure of the League of Nations. One of them would have to be the fact that the United States decided not to be part of it. Can you talk a little bit about, just as background for the formation of the United Nations, why ultimately the League of Nations was not successful?
Well, the League of Nations hung over the UN conference like a black cloud because it was a failure. And the reason why the U.S. Senate in the end decided not to ratify the League Treaty back in 1919-1920 was that the president at that time, Woodrow Wilson, had failed to provide a bipartisan delegation to the Versailles Conference, which devised the League of Nations Charter. He only included Democrats, and he just to sprinkling one or two Republicans who had no influence in the Republican Party. Because of that, the Republican Party felt left out, and therefore, for a number of reasons that they found weaknesses in the Charter, decided to turn against the League and defeated it. Franklin Roosevelt, recognizing that huge omission by Wilson, made clear from the very beginning that when the UN Charter was being drafted, first in the State Department, and later when he sent the delegation out to San Francisco, that there'd be equal number of Republicans as well as Democrats. Hmm. And that was a huge change from, it created a huge different and more positive atmosphere in when the issue of ratification came before the U.S. Senate in July 1945. There was another major change that Roosevelt made. In the League, every nation had the veto. This meant that the League was basically ineffectual because any one small country could veto an action by the League, and that would be the end of it. Roosevelt said, no, in the Charter, the UN Charter, there were only going to be five nations would have the veto. These were the most powerful countries in the world in 1945, which were most likely to supply troops to any military maneuver by a UN. And therefore, only these five countries would have the veto, which would allow the organization to act more expeditiously in the future. And in fact, on the Security Council, those five nations still have the veto, and the Security Council has actually lived up to its promise.
Yeah. Although I suppose that some people would argue that that fact, the fact that the permanent members, the United States, was then Soviet Union, now Russia, also Britain, China, and France, that the fact that they do have the veto power has meant that it has been a problem, because if any of those nations, and they do have competing political interests, see something as being not in their political interest, they can stop it right then.
Well, there's no question that there's a great deal of controversy about the five states getting the vetoes. There was even this similar controversy in 1945. Most of the smaller states coming to San Francisco opposed giving the veto to these five nations and tried to make a fight out of it, but realizing that if they tried to restrict the veto too dramatically, that both the United States and the Soviet Union would walk out of the conference and there would be no UN, they finally backed off. So today, the same problem presents itself in slightly different terms, because the five countries that were politically powerful in 1945 do not represent fairly the political realities of today in 2003. Obviously, Great Britain and France are hardly superpowers of the sort they might have been in 1945. And yes, there are still demands in the UN to at least amend or change the notion of the veto power.
Let me introduce again our guest for this first hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Stephen Schlesinger. He's director of the World Policy Institute at the New School University in New York City. He is a foreign affairs historian and has authored a book that looks at the creation of the United Nations and concentrates specifically on the UN conference, the organizing conference that took place starting in April, running through near the end of June 1945 in San Francisco. And he's authored a book on this. It's titled Act of Creation, The Founding of the United Nations, published by the Westview Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We talked about the fact that people in the U.S. government recognized that to get political support here in the United States, they had to draw in both Republicans and Democrats. They had to have a delegation that represented the various interests so everybody would be on board. And in fact, the delegation included some real heavy hitters in American politics at the time, including Adlai Stevenson, Nelson Rockefeller, Averell Harriman, Harold Stassen, John Foster Dulles, and interestingly enough, Alger Hiss. Though in addition to people like that, whose names we now know, there were also people who played an important role here who certainly are not well-known names today. And particularly I'm thinking about this man who was a State Department official, a man who had been born in Russia, who is now not a well-known name, but was very important in sketching out the form that the United Nations would take, including the idea of the Security Council. Although I believe he, Leo Pasvalsky, actually opposed the idea, I think, of giving the permanent members the veto.
Yes, Leo Pasvalsky was one of those classic faceless bureaucrats, you might call them, that become very powerful in an agency or an organization. In this case, though he had obviously achieved great prominence at Brookings Institute, where he began his career, he was then hired by the then Secretary of State Cordell Hull to be his assistant and assigned the duties of devising a UN charter back in 1939 when Roosevelt realized we were faced with a world war. He spent the next 5 or 6 years working on the draft of this charter, coming up with the key clauses and figuring out how the machinery at the UN would operate. And there were moments when he did oppose certain aspects of the UN document in its totality. For example, in addition to the point you just made, he also had to fight off a number of people who wanted the UN to be a rather weak kind of organization, with regional organizations, subsets of the UN, being more powerful around the globe. This was something that was fought over in the State Department, and he was eventually able to overcome that with the backing of Cordell Hull. But there were a number of instances where his particular suppositions were not supported. On the other hand, because he was singular in the fact that he had worked on the document from literally the very beginning, and he knew where the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed and the very little nuances of each clause, he was indispensable to the U.S. delegation in San Francisco as an advisor. And indeed, in many of the transcripts of the meetings of the U.S. delegation, Leo Pasvalsky's name is always present. People are always turning to him and asking for his advice, and usually whatever he says carries as a final determinant of an outcome on the charter.
Do I remember right that he did not think that it was a good idea for the permanent members of the Security Council to have that veto?
Yes. Well, he was problematic about that. He understood the need to have some sort of veto because he realized that the U.S. Senate would never pass the treaty without that kind of power accorded to the United States. On the other hand, he was very adamant that it should not be an absolute veto, which is what the Russians wanted, the Soviets. The Soviets wanted a veto, I'm going to get a little technical here, but one which would allow them to veto even the notion of discussion of a crisis on the Security Council. Whereas the U.S. said, well, you cannot block discussion. If you don't even have discussion of an issue, what's the point of having a Security Council? And furthermore, the smaller states at least want to have the veto limited to allow talk and conversation among the Security Council delegates about a crisis, because otherwise they can never appeal to the bigger powers for help. So this issue became an intense struggle between the Soviets and the U.S., and it took a special mission by Harry Hopkins on the instructions of Harry Truman. Harry Hopkins had been one of FDR's top aides. midway through the conference, by which Hopkins actually went to Moscow and met with Stalin to finally resolve the question. And the question was resolved in favor of the Americans, and that really saved the UN Charter.
Another important person here whose name certainly would now not be a household name was the man who was at the time the Secretary of State, U.S. Secretary of State, Edward Stettinius, who was the leader of the delegation. And also, interestingly enough, did not have a very positive relationship with Harry Truman. In fact, Truman, his plan was that as soon as the charter was worked out, he was going to replace him. He was going to make somebody else the Secretary of State. I think here again, part of your intention is to restore him to his place, because at the time, maybe there were a lot of people who didn't have a great deal of respect for him, and perhaps since. Let's talk about him.
Edward Stettinius was an interesting figure. He at age 38, he had been head of U.S. Steel Corporation, and at age 44, he was Secretary of State. He was one of those individuals who was very affable, quite attractive-looking, kind of a backslapper, good at small talk, but most of his colleagues in the State Department thought he had scant interest or knowledge of foreign affairs, oddly enough. FDR chose him because he felt that if a UN charter was ever going to be passed by the U.S. Senate, it was important to have a kind of neutral political figure, somebody who was neither Republican nor Democrat, who could argue for it with the U.S. Senate, particularly on a bipartisan basis. But Stettinius, because he didn't seem to have a formidable presence in the question of on the questions of international affairs, did not really have a great standing among his friends and colleagues, not only in the State Department, but just in the foreign policy establishment as a whole. So when he went to San Francisco, it was quite a surprise to see him emerge as a key figure in keeping the U.S. delegation together. And I might say the U.S. delegation had its own group of prima donnas, all of whom were kind of acting on their own, to keep them together, aimed and targeted on this single mission of devising and passing and ratifying a U.N. charter over an 8 or 9 week period. And so Stettinius, though he's disappeared into the mists of history, is owed, I think, the respect of all Americans for having brought the U.N. charter through all the problems and difficulties of that conference to a successful conclusion.
Yeah. I talked a little bit earlier, I mentioned the names of some of the people who are part of the U.S. delegation, and these are people who would become significant names in American history. A number of them ran for president. One of them would in the future be Secretary of State. We had men who were powerful people in Congress. Among the members of the delegation, what were some of the competing agendas?
Well, the Republicans were selected reluctantly by Franklin Roosevelt. He knew he had to have them on there, but he didn't particularly admire or feel comfortable with any of them, particularly Senator Vandenberg, who was a very powerful Republican in the U.S. Senate, who had been a one-time isolationist, but had dramatically delivered a speech early in 1945, turning and embracing internationalism. And so Vandenberg was kind of a iconic figure for the Republicans as a representative on this delegation. But he also felt that he should be representing Republican interests, and he wanted to make very sure that he was not being sucked into some sort of Democratic plan that he might disagree with. His advisor was John Foster Dulles. Dulles was not actually on the delegation, but he was the legal advisor to the delegation. So he and Dulles worked together to make sure that their particular interests were represented. And they were very anti-Soviet, so they wanted to make sure that in almost every case where there was a conflict with the Soviet Union, that the American interests triumphed. And when they were concerned that there might be a drift in the direction of the Soviet Union, they were want to leak stories to the New York Times in order to get their side out and make it part of the public record. There was one particular instance where the issue of the veto, which I just discussed, had become embroiled with the Soviets, and Vandenberg was very, very determined that the U.S. limit the veto in favor of discussion, as I also indicated earlier. But he felt at one point that Satinius wasn't listening to him, and so he and Dulles did leak a story to the New York Times, causing a big uproar in the delegation. But in the end, as you know, because I just explained it, the issue was resolved in the favor of the U.S. delegation. But there were a number of other instances where Republicans felt their interests had to be represented, and they were very sure that the newspapers would be alerted. Now, there were other concerns. Obviously, you mentioned Pasvalsky. Pasvalsky had his own agenda. Stettinius was concerned that he pleased President Truman because he was still hoping to be reappointed Secretary of State under this new president. The people had their different concerns and interests, but in the end, the overwhelming need for a UN charter propelled everybody forward in a consensus that produced the document at the conclusion of the conference.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. They're in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to know if you can tell me a little bit more about what happened to Stettinius afterwards. I was fairly young at the time, but I do have a very vivid memory of newspaper headlines saying about Stettinius committing suicide. And do you have any information on that and the background and reasons and subsequent events?
No, Stettinius died of a heart attack, but only at the age of 50, only about 4 or 5 years after the conference. What happened was that at the 3 days before the conference ended, Truman replaced Stettinius as Secretary of State and brought in a man named Jimmy Burns, a former senator from South Carolina. And he made his face-saving gesture was to make Stettinius the first U.S. emissary to the new United Nations, a post in which Stettinius did serve for a short time, but with no great willingness because he obviously had been demoted. And he then subsequently left the State Department and went into private business. But I think, to be honest, I think his heart was broken. I think this had been his great achievement for the American people, and he didn't really get proper recognition by remaining a Secretary of State. And I'm sure that this must have contributed to his health problems afterwards, but he did not commit suicide.
Yeah, I guess my memory is just bad on that.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Our guest, Stephen Schlesinger, is director of the World Policy Institute at the New School University in New York City. He has also worked at the United Nations. He served as a speechwriter and foreign policy advisor to the governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, for 12 years, and he has contributed to many different magazines and newspapers, including the Washington Post, the LA Times, The Nation, the New York Observer. He's authored a book that explores this history that we're talking about here on the program. It's titled Act of Creation, The Founding of the United Nations. The Westview Press is the publisher, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It seems that one of the big points of struggle, particularly between the forces of the Soviet Union and the West, was the issue of what nations would be, who would be admitted, who would be considered a nation in the body. And as far as the Soviets were concerned, they would have liked to have every one of the republics in the Soviet Union admitted as a separate nation, so they would all get a separate vote. Obviously they wanted to line up as many votes on their side as they possibly could, and I'm sure the feeling was the same on the other side. Can you talk about how this issue of who exactly would be considered a nation for the purpose of having a seat in the United Nations played out?
The Soviet Union was very concerned in the year before the UN conference that it would be underrepresented as far as votes were concerned in the General Assembly. Understandably, Stalin looked at the British Commonwealth, that is, Great Britain and all its colonial possessions, as a single block, you know, representing about 10 or 12 votes. And they thought, well, you know, the British now have an automatic a dozen votes that will always support them on any issue in the General Assembly. And they looked at the United States as sort of the titular head of the Western Hemisphere, and that was another 20 or so votes, including all the Latin nations. So the U.S., as far as Stalin concerned, had an automatic block of about two dozen votes. And what did the Soviet Union have? Well, they only had their single vote, and they felt that even though we might consider all these other republics which made up the Soviet Union as kind of dominated by Russia, that they nonetheless should be counted as separate entities, and therefore they demanded 16 or so votes from the beginning. Well, Roosevelt shot this plan down because he didn't think if that happened that it would that the treaty would pass the U.S. Senate. Eventually, he worked out a deal with Stalin at Yalta where the Soviet Union would get three votes. That would be the Soviet Union, Belarus, and Ukraine would all get votes in the General Assembly. Roosevelt declined to try to get any additional votes for the U.S. based on our 48 states at that time, which was, in fact, considered for a brief moment. That compromise then became part of the conclusion of the talks between all the different powers, the three key powers, Great Britain, U.S., and the Soviet Union, prior to the conference. When the conference actually opened, the Soviets were allowed to have those two additional votes, that is, Ukraine and Belarus. But then the question became whether Poland and Argentina should be admitted. Both of them caused great controversy. Poland, the U.S., and Great Britain opposed because it was a puppet government, communist government, established under the Soviet aegis. On the other hand, Argentina was opposed by the Soviet Union because they felt it was a Nazi-dominated government. Eventually, after many skirmishes and battles, for a lot of different reasons which are a little too complicated to go into at this particular moment, Poland was not admitted, and Argentina was. And this was a suggestion very early on that there were going to be dramatic differences between the West and Soviets over these kind of key issues that emerged at the United Nations. And in many ways, these issues foreshadowed the Cold War, which was set to begin just a year later.
Yeah, this was at a time when World War II was still going on, and ostensibly the Soviet Union and the United States and Britain were allies, but there you can clearly see the tension and the tension growing that would later then be played out in the Cold War.
This is right. I mean, the Cold War was not in the minds of the delegates, particularly the Russian and American delegates at that time, but clearly the differences and struggles that occurred in San Francisco were foreshadowing a much worse situation just a year later.
The Soviets were represented at this conference by the foreign minister of the Soviet Union, Molotov, and also Andrei Gromyko, who was the ambassador to the United States, who at that time, I guess, was relatively young, and he would have a very long career in diplomacy. Perhaps you could talk particularly about Molotov.
Molotov was a crusty, hardline survivor of all the bloody purges in the Soviet Union. He was a master at intrigue, person who had a terrific ability as an infighter. And therefore, when he was sent over, at first, Stalin didn't want to send him at all to the UN conference because he was upset that Roosevelt was being sort of difficult about the admission of Poland into the UN conference. This was all about a month before the conference began. But when Roosevelt died, as a gesture of respect to Harry Truman, Stalin changed his mind and sent Molotov over as head of the Soviet delegation. Molotov had a meeting with Truman in the White House a few days before the conference began, in which the two of them literally had a shouting match over the admission of Poland. And from then on, Molotov and Truman became bitter enemies. And when Molotov went out into San Francisco to start the conference, he was in a foul mood, and he sort of found moments and key issues on which to oppose the United States as almost a kind of way of showing that the Soviet Union was not going to be pushed around. The first kind of small issue which became prominent because of Molotov's opposition was over who should be president of the conference. Well, usually in geopolitical protocol, the host country is the president of the conference, in this case the United States. But Molotov absolutely insisted that the five veto-bearing countries all co-share the presidency. Finally, that was resolved as in a compromise, but that kind of set the tone for the rest of his presence in the conference. He stayed for the first month or so, and then his assistant, that U.S. ambassador, the Russian ambassador to the U.S., Gromyko, took over. But Molotov was a tough cookie, and he never gave an inch unless he absolutely was under the most intense pressure. So in many ways, he faithfully represented the kind of hardline attitudes of his boss, Stalin.
We have some other callers here to bring in. Someone on a cell phone on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah. Actually, I find it interesting that the Cold War in many ways wasn't really, you know, sort of on a lot of these people's radars. I mean, it's quite possible that it wasn't, but Hitler was playing for time in the latter part of World War II, as he wrote repeatedly. You know, this is a crazy alliance. You know, the U.S. and the U.K. allied with the USSR is just, you know, this is indeed strange bedfellows. And I think what he had really been hoping for near the end of the war, this is Hitler, was that the tensions would erupt. Now, they didn't until after the war, thankfully enough. But I don't think it's terribly surprising that the whole thing fell apart afterwards. I mean, if you look at what was going on before the war, people were more worried about the USSR and had things played out differently. World War II could have played out very, very, very differently. In those early years. Anyway, I'm going to hang up and listen.
Well, I think that the caller raises an interesting point, which is that obviously in the 1930s, the fear of communism was at large in this country, and there was a whole question because of the New Deal reforms about whether more radical left-wing activity might happen in the United States. New Deal, in fact, kind of diffused that problem, but what happens in a wartime, you know, the enemy of my enemy becomes my friend, and the Soviet Union was absolutely critical to defeating the Nazis. I mean, at Stalingrad and Leningrad, and all the great battles of the Second World War, most of them were fought by the Soviets, who lost over 20 million people. They were signal and close and absolutely critical allies to both Great Britain and the United States. So in 1945, that alliance still seemed solid. Sure, there had been stresses and strains throughout the 5 years of the war, but the fact that Roosevelt had just met with Stalin at Yalta a few months before the conference and had been meeting with him on a regular basis before, during the entire war, meant that there was still a strong feeling that this alliance would go forward and, in fact, keep the peace of the world after the Second World War ended. And even the disputes, during the disputes in San Francisco, Harry Truman was always reassuring Citinius, well, we can work this out with the Soviets. We need them to keep the peace in the future. There was no direct sense yet at that time there was going to be a fundamental split between the West and the Soviet Union. In retrospect, clearly it was coming and probably should have been foreseen. But at that time, people were still wanting to end the Second World War. It still was not ended in Europe, and it still had obviously not ended in the Pacific. So that's where people's concerns were, and they were still hoping that the alliance would survive the end of the war and last for many years to come.
We'll go on. We have another caller here on line two in Savoy. Hello.
Yeah, I guess I got a question along the same lines as this. You know, looking back in history, you know, Uncle Joe was something else. And, you know, it just amazed me, you know, that people really thought that they could do business with him. And, you know, and there was considerable thought about, you know, taking some preemptive action against him after the war. And from all that I've read and everything, the things that went on in the Soviet Union during the war and then following it, it kind of made Hitler look like an amateur. Was there any real serious thought given to excluding Stalin and his regime at the end of the war from this organization?
That's an interesting question. In fact, no. I mean, in fact, just the opposite. Franklin Roosevelt was so determined to bring the Soviet Union into the United Nations that it was never an issue of trying to exclude them. He realized that without the Soviet Union's involvement in the UN, this organization would never get off the ground, because here you would have the other greatest power on the planet, the USSR, not participating in the prime foremost international security organization in existence. And so he determined that he would go to any length to bring in Stalin. And that's why, even though he was an ill man, he went to Yalta in February of 1945 to guarantee that Stalin would agree to the conditions he set out for the creation of the UN. And he was absolutely determined that the Soviet Union not be given any excuse to stay out. Now, of course, there was a feeling during the conference itself that by the bad behavior that Stalin and his emissaries were showing in the conference, that particularly Truman felt, well, if they're going to behave in this terrible way, in ways that are so disruptive, that we may have to kick them out.
Yeah.
But even Truman himself, in the end, determined that the UN could not survive without Russia's involvement, and therefore he did make some accommodations during the deliberations to make sure that the Soviet Union stayed. On the other hand, on key issues like the absolute veto versus the limited veto, he was adamant that he was not going to bow down to the Soviets, and he eventually made them cave in.
Yeah.
So there were issues on which the U.S. did triumph.
Yeah, it was really interesting, you know, the way you're talking and everything and the way it came about. And, you know, and it was the other, I think that you could also see another sign that the Cold War was, you know, was going to be long and bitter was whenever Stalin refused the Marshall Plan aid, too, you know, and that kind of sealed the deal there.
Not only the Marshall Plan, he refused to join the IMF and the World Bank.
Yeah, that's right, and you know, so I was just wondering if people didn't, you know, kind of could see this coming and think about ways of limiting that in the beginning.
I think that obviously there were people who were suspicious of Stalin all during the war, all through the war. But it was, again, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah.
We had to work with these people in order just to defeat the Nazis.
Yeah. Hey,
like,
That's an interesting subject.
All right. Yeah. Well, yeah, thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And again, for anyone who's just joined us, I better introduce once again our guest, Stephen Schlesinger. He's director of the World Policy Institute at the New School University in New York City and is the author of a book that explores this bit of history in greater depth. It's titled Act of Creation, the Founding of the United Nations, and it's recently published by the Westview Press. Just came out in September. So if you would like to read more, you can look for the book. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You mentioned a little bit earlier that you're talking about the fact that it was Molotov and Gromyko represented the interests of the Soviet Union at the conference and were very tough. And that in an effort to ultimately make this happen, the United States did an end run around them and went right to Stalin, who was obviously was the person who was making the final decisions. And I'm interested in having you talk a little bit particularly about Harry Hopkins, who was the man who was sent to try to talk with Stalin and get him to drop some of the most difficult things that he was asking for. And a lot of people, I think, would say, I think you make the argument that if there was anybody who deserves the credit for pulling this thing out of the fire, it was him. And he was a man who at the time was very ill. He had cancer and, in fact, was in the last months of his life. He died in January of the next year, I believe. Tell us about Harry Hopkins.
Harry Hopkins was one of Franklin Roosevelt's closest aides, and he actually had originally worked on the domestic side of Roosevelt's New Deal. It wasn't until the war began that he got involved in the international affairs. But because he was so close to Roosevelt, he actually, in the end, lived in the White House during the Second World War. He was that intimate a colleague of Roosevelt's. Because of his relationship with Roosevelt, was with FDR when FDR met with Stalin. So he had become acquainted with Stalin at several of the key meetings during the Second World War. And for that reason, when Truman took over, he decided that Harry Hopkins would be the perfect person to send to meet with Stalin to resolve this issue over the arguments over the veto. He knew that Hopkins was in serious health had a serious health problem, namely stomach cancer. But Hopkins rallied for this particular trip and said he would do it. And he made a very strenuous airplane trip, took almost 2 days just to get to Moscow, and then spent 2 weeks in the capital city having a series of meetings with Stalin. But the most critical meeting was the one over the veto. And when he finally presented the issue to Stalin, Stalin claimed not to know anything about it. Well, he apparently at that time turned to Gromyko and said something in Russian, which was translated by Charles Bolin, one of our key State Department officials who spoke Russian, as saying, Molotov, tell me about what is this? I don't know anything about it. Well, I think he did that with a certain amount of deception, because clearly Stalin had to know that the veto was the critical issue affecting the UN. He had a direct line into his own delegation. But I think he wanted to pretend that he was making a dramatic concession. And so when they finished their conversation in Russian, Stalin turned to Hopkins and said, listen, no problem. We understand your desire for a more limited veto. We will accept it. Why did Stalin cave in so quickly? Well, I think Hopkins had indicated to Stalin that Truman was not going to take action against the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe. Once Stalin realized that there was going to be U.S. recognition of its interests in Eastern Europe, he decided he was not going to make a fight over the veto, that the U.S. had given him enough of a concession so that he could, in turn, give in on this issue. And I think that's how the deal was finally concluded.
We have a couple of callers here. I don't know if we'll be able to get both of them. We'll try. We'll get at least one. They're both on cell phones. First is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Dave. I had an interesting thought. First of all, if you were going to recreate or reinvent the United Nations today, if you were going to hold the San Francisco conference, geopolitics has changed a lot, and there are two fundamental issues. The issue is of peacekeeping or policing, whichever you want to call it, and secondarily, recognition of other economic interests that weren't existent then, Japan, India, for instance, and then Islamic nations as a group, because more and more they seem to be operating in some ways as a group. So I'll hang up, and I just pose the question, how would you go about recreating the United Nations with those factors involved? Thank you.
All right.
Well, the question is a very important one, and it's being debated even now in the UN. It comes most prominently about what the configuration of the Security Council would be under a new UN charter. Most countries feel that the Security Council, as constituted, does not represent the political realities of today. Great Britain and France surely are not on the same level of power as the old Soviet Union, now Russia, the United States, and China. But even Russia might not be included in that because it's a weak economic state at this point. So obviously countries like Germany and Japan and India and Brazil should probably be represented as permanent members on the Security Council. The difficulty, though, is that to reconvene the San Francisco conference at this time would be incredibly difficult. To get 191 nations to agree on a new charter, I think would be practically impossible. And frankly, I don't even think the old UN charter today would pass the American Senate. I don't think that they would be willing to enact it again because of the grievances that they feel, many members of Congress feel towards the UN for, I think, the wrong reasons. As for the Muslim nations, well, actually, they already do have a bloc at the UN, and their interests are represented under the current General Assembly. Perhaps not quite in the way they would like, but certainly the key interests are presented on a regular basis at the UN. But I do think that the political and geopolitical configuration is much different today than it was in 1945, and that the UN Charter is creaky in many ways and needs to be updated. And there is talk of convening a second conference, at least to amend the charter, maybe not create a new one. And that's something which is still under discussion.
Well, there we must stop. My apologies to the last caller. Well, we've simply come to the end of the time, and we'll have to leave it at that, with, again, the reminder that if you're interested in reading in more detail about this story, you should look for this book that we've mentioned. It's titled Act of Creation, The Founding of the United Nations. It's published by Westview Press by our guest, Stephen Schlesinger. He's director of the World Policy Institute at the New School University in New York City. And, Mr. Schlesinger, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.